I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Dr. Ira Bowen, Senior Neurosurgical Resident at Riverside University Health System in Southern California. And now, join Shiva Schultz on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Dr. Ira Bowen.
Welcome, and thank you for coming to the third annual Brain Fitness Forum. It's great to see so many people interested in keeping our brains working and healthy. Today, for our first talk, in addition to our ongoing focus on dementia and Alzheimer's, we are turning our attention to brain injury. I'm going to now introduce Dr. Ira Bowen. He is a senior neurosurgical resident at Riverside University Hospital System in Southern California. Dr. Bowen graduated from West Virginia School of Osteopathic Medicine, and before attending medical school, he worked as a research associate for Children's Hospital of Los Angeles, Department of Neurosurgery, for many years, studying traumatic brain injury, brain tumors, and congenital diseases. Dr. Bowen continues to have a special interest in pediatric neurosurgery and recently reunited with his colleagues in Southern California to collaborate on studying the prevention and treatment of concussion and other forms of traumatic brain injury. I'm very glad to welcome him here. He's come up from Southern California. Let's give him a big round of applause.
Well, thank you for the introduction. And my goal today, what I'm hoping to contribute, is sort of to give you a window into the front lines of very severe traumatic brain injuries and the science and treatment that's going on at big centers around the world, but to sort of take that science and show you what we're learning about how the brain heals itself and what we can do just on a daily basis for everyone to help encourage our brain to be sort of in its optimum health levels and to heal from any minor injuries. So I'll give you a little background about my sort of unique story of how I became interested in neuroscience and specifically brain injury and even further into more how the brain is healing itself. And I'd always kind of been interested in the brain, and in college I took a few neuroscience classes. I went to college at Occidental in Southern California. It's sort of a small liberal arts school no one's really heard of. We're famous because Obama went there for 2 years before he transferred somewhere that you have heard of. But sort of fate intervened, and at the same time I graduated from college, my little brother, Shane, was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And he'd been having symptoms for several months, but very subtle symptoms. You know, he was just kind of a little off balance. He was always breaking things. We all feel bad in retrospect because we were making fun of how uncoordinated and goofy he was going through this growth spurt. And even his doctors didn't really think there was anything that suspicious until things really crashed. And just one night he had an excruciating headache, became very, very lethargic, not himself, ended up in the hospital. And they found that he had a very large brain tumor in his cerebellum, in sort of the back lower part of the brain. And it had grown large enough that it was actually pushing on his brainstem. So he was medevaced down to Children's Hospital in the middle of the night. They did surgery. And he was very fortunate because the tumor was benign and they were able to remove all of it. He recovered relatively quickly, was home within a week, doing well. And sort of as a token of thanks, my family invited the surgeon, Dr. Krieger, to a 4th of July party, and I started talking to him there, and he was explaining some of the research he was doing and that they were a little short-handed. So I started going there on my free time, helping out with these research projects, and eventually, by the end of the summer, CHLA actually hired me full-time, And that's where I started to really learn about neurosurgery, but also develop an interest in medicine and the clinical side of it, taking care of patients. And that's sort of when I realized I wanted to go to medical school. So when I was looking into medical schools, I discovered osteopathic medical schools. And I knew a little bit about it because my parents were sort of more inclined towards Eastern medicine. And when I went to school in West Virginia, and there I would refer to my parents as hippies. Here in San Francisco, you would just probably say normal. But they were much, much more in tune with things like osteopathic medicine, chiropractor, stuff like that. So I wanted to see what it was all about. And I really related to what they call the four tenets of osteopathic medicine when I was going to these schools. And that is, number one is the body is a unit. It's all one interconnected thing. And that unit is capable of self-regulation and healing and maintenance. And that's important to keep in mind. They also, the third tenet is that the structure and function of your body are all interrelated. And basically the whole purpose of it is that rational medical treatment should all be geared towards understanding these concepts, that everything is working together as a single unit and each different piece of it is connected. And that's an excellent way to approach medicine. So I was very excited about that and wanted to head in that direction. So after medical school, neurosurgery residency, now we're way back into hyper-focused Western medicine. I kind of went the other direction. We're just take the tumor out and you're cured. We forget you even have a body associated with your brain. And that's when I started to realize that after the surgeries, you know, people aren't getting a whole lot of information on what to do later on. You know, tumor's gone, great, you're cured. But there's a lot of physical repercussions, there's a lot of emotional repercussions, and there's a long-term healing process that I saw with my little brother that isn't necessarily being addressed that well with all the resources that we know about nowadays. We're not utilizing all of them. And once again, my brother intervened and sort of sacrificed his body for my career, and he fell out of a tree and sustained a pretty severe traumatic brain injury. They didn't really know what to do, so they sent him back down to CHLA because of his history. And I don't want to call him out, but we in neurosurgery, these type of injuries, we call them hold my beer injuries, because it's usually a couple of drunk guys late at night trying to impress each other. It's like, hold my beer, I'm going to get to the top of that tree. But luckily, Shane again recovered from the traumatic brain injury, but this time it was much slower. And the biggest thing I noticed here was he came home and there was really nothing to do except wait. And that was really hard on the family because my parents are very over-nurturing and caring, and they're like, what can we do? What should he be eating? What should he be doing? Like, was he just sit around to like hope he gets better? You know, there wasn't a lot of support or information provided. So if you want to see the best example of every aspect of medicine and science and anything Eastern, Western, all working together, the best place to look is in professional sports. This is when there's a lot of money at stake and everyone comes in, and it actually works. You know, it's a good system. It's just wish we could do it that way for everyone. So what do we know now, and how can this affect our daily life? That's sort of what I want to focus on today. Is how the stuff we're learning about the brain can be applied to everyone, not just during injuries. So what is mild traumatic brain injury? And this is sort of a term that gets used more frequently now, and especially in neurosurgery or neurology circles. We're sort of moving away from the term concussion because it was being used kind of all over the place and not very accurately. And the term mild traumatic brain injury also conveys that there actually is injury, and that's sort of the key part when we're treating this. And we're going to look at some of the things we can do about these mild brain injuries, and as I say, how that's going to apply to you. And I'll give you a little bit of a spoiler to this. There's sort of four key areas that are going to keep coming up, and that's nutrition, sleep, neuroplasticity, which I'll get into the details and definitions of that in a little bit, and exercise. And it's not just exercise, but also sort of lumping in the physical components of healing to that. So the true definition of a mild traumatic brain injury or concussion is it's basically a force sustained to the skull that's causing the brain to move rapidly within the skull, and that rapid movement or shock to the brain is resulting in either an emotional, physical, mental changes. Something's changing in the brain activity. And more importantly, too, this is something you don't see on imaging. There's no, you can get a CT scan or an MRI. There's no bleeding. There's no swelling. There's no fracture. You know, this is looks like the brain looks fine, but you're seeing these symptoms that's clearly indicating there's some level of lower lying injury in the brain. So here's a little description of the sort of mechanism of how this happens. It's basically just basic physics. Your brain is floating in your skull. It's surrounded by CSF, which is your cerebral spinal fluid. It goes through the ventricles in the middle of your brain and out around the edges, and then there's a kind of a thick membrane called the dura, which encases it all. But other than that, it's basically just floating in the skull. And so when you sustain some sort of force to the skull, the brain is pushing forward. And then there's even, through physics, a backwards push, which you can get injury in the back part of the brain, the opposite side. They call that a coup-counter-coup injury. And it doesn't take a lot of force. When you have the skull rapidly decelerate, the brain sort of becomes like a passenger in a car without a seatbelt. They're just bouncing around in there, even with very little momentum. So looking at some of the statistics, the CDC has been studying this more and more recently, especially in the 2000s. And they found this in 2014, there were nearly 3 million TBI-related visits to the ERs around the country. And that is a lot compared to 10 years before, 8 years before, in 2006, there wasn't even half that. And nowadays we're seeing even higher numbers. But it's actually a good thing, because we think a large part of that is because people are now more aware of these importance of early screening on these injuries and actually getting these checked out. So coaches at schools are much more inclined to send kids to the hospital if they've had a head injury, and parents as well. Also, we're getting better at catching it. We're having much more unified systems in ERs put in place so that if the story doesn't sound that dramatic, you still get the screen and the cognitive assessment so you can catch more subtle injuries, which we used to miss a lot. So talking about some of the signs and symptoms, the stuff, these are just sort of the mild symptoms that come along with these small injuries to the brain. And the biggest one is confusion. And this is also sort of the toughest one, because it's very easy to write that off, that, oh, you got the wind knocked out of you, or, you know, you're just kind of dazed. We see it all the time, especially teenagers playing sports. They want to downplay it. They don't want to pretend like they're hurt, or so they'll, it's unless you're really checking and really asking the right questions, it's very easy to miss the confusion. And the confusion is one of the key symptoms that's indicating there's some underlying brain injury. You can be a little confused for a few seconds and sort of reorient yourself after 5 minutes, but if there's any kind of confusion that's persisting, it's because there's some small injury happening to the brain. The other stuff is more obvious. Amnesia, if you don't remember what happened, or you don't remember, you know, who you are or where you went to school, obviously those are the sort of things you're going to get checked out. Balance and difficulty, we see a lot of injury where they come out and that, you know, they look drunk, and that's sort of a sign that there's, you know, usually injury to more of the lower cerebellar parts that's controlling your movement. Slow reaction time, headache, obviously very common, but not very specific. Everyone's got headaches. Difficulty concentrating, you see that after these hits to the head, they can't stay on task. And these are all signs that there's some underlying injury, and also we see a lot of emotional changes, but much more irritable, short temper, sometimes depressed. And I wouldn't be a neurosurgeon if I didn't go through the red flag signs with you. These are the ones where you call 911 and go straight to the hospital. And one of those that people don't always think of is loss of consciousness. If you get hit hard enough in the head to knock you out, there's a really good chance there's a more serious injury happening in your brain. And also, there's a much higher likelihood that you have injury to the nerves and even arteries in your neck, because it actually takes quite a bit of force to knock you out. So anytime there's a loss of consciousness, we recommend going straight to the hospital. Nausea and vomiting, especially if it's progressing, getting worse and worse, is just out of nowhere, really sick to their stomach and throwing up a lot. That's really concerning, because that is what happens when the pressure in your brain is building up. It presses on centers in the medulla that trigger your gag response. A lucid interval, you'll hear about this. This is when you get a blow to the head, maybe you lose consciousness, maybe you don't, and you feel fine. You're your normal self, and then 20, 30 minutes later, the symptoms start to come on, where now all of a sudden they become very stuporous or tired or something's obviously wrong. And what's happening in that scenario is a vessel, a blood vessel, on the surface of the brain has broken, and it's building up blood slowly. And when that clot and the big blood starts to build up and put pressure on the brain, that's when you get the symptoms. And that can take a little while. It can be a little bit delayed. The scary part is once it hits that level of pressure, it can get a lot worse a lot faster. So that's generally a surgical emergency for us and something to be aware of. Anisocoria, this is a fancy word for just the pupils not being the same size. That can indicate injury to the brain. It's not always. You can actually have pupillary injury as well, but if one pupil is noticeably larger, that warrants a trip to the hospital. Seizures, of course. I think anybody you see a new seizure, you're going to go to the hospital. Any sort of weakness, really, but especially lateralizing weakness, if you notice this person's one side is completely weak or a lot weaker than the other side, that is pointing to the brain. You see it obviously with stroke, but we can see it as well with brain injury and same with things like slurred speech. So just stuff everyone should sort of be aware of. And nowadays people are more aware. Coaches are trained in these things and in the general public too, but there's still a lot to be learned. So going back to the actual injury, one thing we work on is discerning the severity as early as possible, because this is going to give us an indication as to what the outcomes are and what our plan of attack needs to be and how aggressive or how sort of relaxed we can be in monitoring these things. And there's a ton of different systems. The biggest ones are the American Association of Neurology and the American Association of Neurological Surgery. There's also the Colorado Medical Society, I think the Cantu Medical Group, or everyone's got their own concussion grading system, but they all sort of focus on the same three things, which is confusion, amnesia, and loss of consciousness. So I've sort of given you a kind of a summary here to get the gist of what we're calling it. And I prefer the term grade one, because they also see them as marked as mild. But when we're talking about mild traumatic brain injury, and then we're breaking it back down into another category of mild subset, moderate, severe, it's just a little confusing. So we also use grade ones, two, and three. Grade one is basically you took a hit to the head, you're confused, you're not quite yourself, but you don't have any memory loss, and you didn't lose consciousness. Grade two, now confusion is sort of always going to be there, but now we're having memory loss. It's usually very short term. It's just lasting in the 15-minute interval around the injury, where you don't remember what happened. You might even not remember your name, but within about 15 minutes, that's really coming back, and then your memory is sort of intact from there on. And again, no loss of consciousness. Basically, anytime you have a loss of consciousness or continued memory loss that's not resolving right away, that is what we're classifying as sort of grade three, and these are the ones that we want to be the most careful with and sort of the most diligent with, because we will see things like post-concussion syndrome, which is sort of the same symptoms, physical or cognitive changes, this lack of concentration, emotional irritability, maybe some imbalance, confusion, things like that. But in this situation, it's not going away, and it'll last for 6 to 8 weeks. We see it lasting, and it's actually much more likely to happen after multiple injuries. So that's your second concussion. You're much more likely to develop these sort of post-concussion syndromes, which is why we need to be aware of the severity so that we can be sort of protective and preventing further injury.
You're listening to Dr. Ira Bowen, Senior Neurosurgical Resident at Riverside University Health System in Southern California, on BINA, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. BINA is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Back to sort of what we used to do with this and bloodletting, because in even the most severe traumatic injuries, science hasn't changed a lot. They were doing trepanation and cutting holes in the skull thousands of years ago, and now if we come in the most severe swelling, all we can do is remove a big piece of the skull and let that brain swell out. And the only difference is we do it a lot faster and with less infection rates, but it's still the same concept as many years ago. And we were even doing less changes in actual mild brain injury. That, if you even did anything at all, they would just say, put ice on it, go in a dark room. And there was always the rumors, you don't go to sleep after you've had a concussion. And that sort of goes back to that lucid interval, which is people were worried that you would, have some sort of small bleed, you go back to your room, you go to sleep, and then you never wake up because that bleeding progressed throughout the night. But in reality, when those bleeds get bigger, it usually creates a ton of pain and nausea and vomiting before it really gets worse. So usually people wake up and it's like something's really wrong. And also that usually happens within a 6-hour window. It's very rare to have any bleeding that's still going on actively without symptoms after 6 hours. So if you're home that evening, it's not probably that serious to sleep. However, again, if you're concerned, if you got hit your head hard enough that you're, worried about sleeping by yourself, you just go to the hospital. The CT scan will take 5 minutes. The wait in the ER might take 12 hours, but my part will take 10 minutes. I can. So what do we know now? And we're learning this, especially in much more severe injuries, people in comas. And what we're seeing is that the brain is extremely vulnerable on a cellular level in the days and weeks after the initial injury. And that's when we see something called second impact syndrome, which is similar to the post-concussion syndrome, but that is a second injury shortly after an initial injury can be dramatically more severe, and there's sort of a compounding effect when the brain is this sensitive. And you usually see that with an injury in the first week, sort of 3 to 5 days, but even a month out, a very small injury, even smaller than the first injury, can cause much, much worse symptoms. And so that's sort of where we step in and try and prevent these secondary injuries. And the other thing we're learning a lot more about now are the long-term effects. Now that we've been studying brain injury and concussion and actually keeping track of everything, what we're seeing is people who've had concussions are at higher risk for developing epilepsy, Alzheimer's, and Parkinson's disease, just to name a few. We also see something sort of almost separate entity in itself, which is chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And that's what we're seeing in football players and wrestlers, people who are undergoing lots of small blows to the head, oftentimes not that dramatic, but repetitive over years and years. And thanks to people like Dr. Omalu, who have studied this, and thanks to some of the advances in technology, we're able to see now what's happening to those brains. And what you're getting are a couple of things. You're getting a lot of buildup of little proteins, most commonly tau, and you're also leading to neuronal loss. And we're seeing that it's sort of, you can see there's similarities between chronic traumatic encephalopathy and Alzheimer's and various other brain diseases. So now that we're understanding what's happening, we can be a little bit more active in how we're treating it and how we're preventing it. And that comes into sort of the microbiology of it. Basically, these cells are exquisitely sensitive to hypoxia. They need oxygen much more importantly, and low dips in oxygen levels to these cells can be really drastic, which normally they would tolerate fine. During these periods, you know, days to weeks after the injury, they're really sensitive. And there's sort of several different facets to that, but the basic thing is just a oxidative stress, and that is that during this sensitive time, the brain is also needing more energy, and it's producing a ton of what's NADPH. It's just making the energy, that's the process, and that process leads to reactive oxygen species, and these are basically little free radical byproducts that break off while it's generating this energy. And these byproducts irritate the blood-brain barrier, and it starts to get kind of leaky, and eventually it'll break down in areas. And when that happens, it starts triggering cell death. This is actually really interesting because one of the newest discoveries, which is sort of the most exciting, is the discovery of something called the glymphatic system, or glymphatics. And it was actually proposed in the 1800s, but more recently a Danish scientist sort of found the actual mechanism of it, and he's able to show how it's actually happening. And basically the purpose of the glymphatics is to sort of clear waste products from the brain, just the way that your regular lymphatic system is clearing waste throughout the rest of the body. It makes sense that it would be in your brain. We just didn't really know how to prove that it was there because it's happening on such a microscopic level. The CSF that is normally in your ventricles and circulating around the surface of your brain, it gets absorbed into the interstitial tissue, which is just the tissue of your brain. And while it's in there, these glial cells are absorbing it, and they're basically transporting it through these special channels. And once it gets through the channels, it's then transported into the venous system and cleared out of the body. And one of those main things you'll see is amyloid beta, which also comes up in a lot of dementia diseases. And when the glymphatic system is not working appropriately or as effectively as it can, that amyloid beta is not being cleared well, and you get buildups. And that's sort of where we're headed in the science of making sure we can keep that flow going, and what else can we do to actually improve it. And one thing we'll talk about in a bit is sleep. This process is much more active when we're sleeping. So now we know to encourage sleep. And one of the things we do differently now is the cognitive assessment. So now anyone with a suspected injury, we're doing a pretty quick but detailed cognitive assessment. So we're now catching a lot of subtle injuries that before probably would have been sent right back into the game and get a worse injury. But now we're able to, we know the importance of checking people right away. We're also taking some of the basic stuff more seriously. You know, a lot of these brain stuff, it's very simple science. It's very easy to help heal, but we didn't know all of the science behind proving it. So now we know sleep is really paramount in brain recovery, and so is nutrition. And we'll talk about all of these things in much more detail. And of course, we have a much lower threshold for further workup. If we're on the fence, we're getting the CT scan, or we're getting another imaging, or we're keeping you out for a couple weeks just to play it safe. And that's where these appropriate return to work or return to play guidelines have come in, especially in high school sports, but now also on professional levels. And I'll give you sort of the breakdown of it in a second, but if you really want a lot of great information on it, the CDC has a program called Heads Up, and they have information for every different person. They have information for teenage players, for parents, for coaches, for doctors, for really every different level. They have sort of a little great information packet for you and a lot of statistics. So if you're interested, you can look into that later. But basically the gist of when you're okay to go back after a minor injury to your brain is sort of working through the steps of activity. And the initial one starts with just resuming your daily activity, either going back to work or going back to school, and see how you're doing. The next step is then adding in physical activity, light physical activity, 5 to 10 minutes a day, walk around the block a couple times, nothing major. And then from there, moving up to moderate activity where we're getting the heart rate up, but we're not overexerting it. Maybe go for a short jog, swimming, something like that that's very easy but still keeps your heart rate up. And then you move on to heavy activity. This is stuff where you're sweating, your heart rate's high, whatever you were doing before at your normal health level, going to the gym, going for a run or a bike ride, that you're really sort of pushing yourself. And then if you make it through all of those and you're still feeling fine and normal, and that's the key, then we can talk about, if it's a player, you know, putting them back into a contact sport situation at a practice level, and then eventually returning to competitive contact sports. And the key throughout this entire process is that if you develop any symptoms, we start over at the beginning. So you make it, you know, you start getting up to moderate activity and you're going for a little bike ride, and then you start getting confused again, or you start getting headaches and nausea, then we stop, we start over, because we don't want to push the brain. We don't want to put you in that scenario where you can get a re-injury just because you were, you know, almost better, but the brain obviously hadn't completely healed. And that's where we're looking at the multiple injuries. What happens when you get more than one concussion? Because generally speaking, if you've had a kind of a mild concussion with sort of grade one, and it's the first one you've ever had, we usually give it about a week and work through that process and get you back to normal activity. But if it's your second concussion, we're looking at a month now, and usually a more detailed workup, even for the most mild concussions. Once it's your third concussion, this is sort of, it's definitely over for the entire season, and, you know, these are all modeled after athletes mostly, so we refer to the sports seasons, but anyone who's had three concussions is basically out for the year for any kind of physical activity that could lead to any sort of brain injury. And really, that's when you want to have the discussion about just no more contact sports ever again, because when you start getting into the multiple 3, 4, 5 concussions, we're going to start seeing a sort of acute rise or exponential rise in things like chronic traumatic encephalopathy later on in life. And again, loss of consciousness, putting you in that more concerning category. We're giving, if it was a quick, you know, very short loss of consciousness, maybe 2 weeks. Usually, I think nowadays, everyone would probably go 4 weeks for any duration of loss of consciousness, but the original studies were, I think, less than 30 seconds and over 30 seconds for 2 to 4 weeks. But so now sort of the gist of what we can all actually take away from this stuff is what can we do to help with the healing? Once the injury's happened and we know everything we can do to prevent getting hit in the head again as best we can, what can we actually do to help the brain speed up the healing process and be at the optimum, you know, peak fitness? Because we do so much. Everybody's doing stuff to keep their heart healthy and their gut healthy, and we know all these things, but we don't really ever actively think about doing stuff to keep our brain healthy. And so that's sort of what I want to talk about from here on out. And as I mentioned, these are going to be sort of four main categories, which are nutrition, sleep, neuroplasticity, which I promise we'll get into, and the sort of exercise and physical components to it. So we'll talk about nutrition first, because it really is one of the most important ones. They did a large trial in Philadelphia and New Jersey where doctors actually prescribed a very detailed diet regimen of high-quality organic foods in low-income neighborhoods, and they found a really dramatic shift in hospital visits and overall healthcare costs dropped about 50%. Patients are taking less medication, they're going to their doctor less often, and when they did get hospitalized, these patients were much less likely to be in the hospital for very long. The actual time in the hospital dropped way down, I think about 30-40%. So why is nutrition so important in the brain? Well, we know how important nutrition is overall from countless studies, but the brain itself, it makes up about 2% of your overall body mass, but it actually uses, at baseline, just normal, uses about 20% of your energy, and generally in the form of glucose. So during injury, the brain is actually in sort of a hypermetabolic state. It's cranking up, and we're seeing that go up almost 200% in some cases. So your body is going to need more energy, and your brain can get it from other places if it needs to. It can start breaking down fats, and it can do ketogenesis and things like that, but those have a lot more byproducts and free radicals generated. I know we all like the idea of burning fat, but in your brain it's not good because there's a lot of byproducts to it. So we try to avoid that. We want to have the brain have everything it needs. And by doing that, this nutrition can combat secondary injury that's happening on a cellular level. And that's sort of what we want to apply to regular stuff, is keeping your brain in a place where it's strong and able to tackle just the daily pollutants and toxins and things that it's exposed to. So what should we eat? Unfortunately, it's not pizza and soda. Your brain might tell you it is, but don't listen to it. What we know about nutrition for brain recovery, there have been a lot of different studies, and it's taken a while because they're difficult to study. It takes a lot of lab science to evaluate levels of different compounds, different amino acids, different things in the brain. It also oftentimes requires an actual brain specimen. You know, no one is going to do surgery, get a biopsy just to find out how much vitamin C is in the brain. So we have to sort of slowly but surely gather all this information. What we have seen in multiple studies is that omega-3 is shown to actually stimulate repair of cellular repair after traumatic events. So that's one we're using heavily right now. And amino acids, we use a sort of mix of amino acids in patients in comas, but now we're actually individually isolating and looking at the different ones, and we actually found that arginine levels are associated with better survival rates. People with high levels of arginine were actually having better outcome, and so we're now just sort of incorporating that into people with minor injuries. It's not going to hurt to have your arginine levels up a little bit. You're getting those from things like turkey and pumpkin seeds. It's actually a good source. Also, omega-3s, you know, we know a lot in fish, and sardines are a really high source. We also recommend sardines because they're small, so they don't have as much mercury content. And then zinc. Zinc's another one that we found to be really highly associated with faster neurologic recovery. And this mostly came from stroke trials. People had strokes, were recovering quickly from zinc, and initially we thought it was more of the neurons themselves requiring the zinc, but a more recent trial on traumatic brain injury actually showed that high zinc levels resulted in quicker recovery as well. So those are some simple things that we can all just sort of, you know, incorporate into daily vitamin regimens. Overall diet, when there's brain injury, because of that increased metabolic demand, we go for a very high fat and very high protein ratios. Interestingly, when I was in medical school, I remember when I was studying for boards, being, you know, I'm sleeping like 2 hours a night and I'm so stressed and just studying all day long, and I was constantly craving bacon and strawberries. I don't know why, but I mean, these were like cravings that would wake you up at night. It was so weird. And then later on, I was talking to a friend of mine. She's an acupuncturist, actually here in the Bay Area, and she had mentioned that in Chinese medicine, bacon was considered a brain food. And so I was sold after that. I was like, all right, this, all the bacon I can eat, and strawberries. Another important thing is just overall hydration. To clear those metabolites, your CSF is predominantly water, and any injury leads to a little bit of dehydration. On an average basis, most people are a little on the dry side to begin with, so we usually find that, you know, levels of just increasing it, you know, from where you normally are, adding 20 to 40% more will show enough of a increase to have adequate clearance. We do, you know, there is the stuff, wine can help you. In actual brain injury, alcohol is sort of worse than it is good because of two things. One, it leads to increased dehydration, and the other thing is it affects your sleep, and that it can actually change the REM and deeper stages a little bit, keep you in a lighter sleep. And it's in those deeper stages when the brain's doing more recovery. So I'm not going to stop you for having wine later. Just stop a few hours before you go to bed, and you'll be okay. promise.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is Dr. Ira Bowen, senior neurosurgical resident at Riverside University Health System in Southern California. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So, moving on to sleep, we know it's when the body repairs itself the most. I mean, obviously, it's rejuvenating when you go to sleep. And what we also know is the brain is repairing itself during sleep. These studies of lymphatics, they found that they increase quite a bit, almost to double the levels while you're actually sleeping. So sleep deprivation is making brain healing slow down, and you're getting further buildup of things like amyloid beta. Following concussion and brain injury, people are often very sleepy and lethargic and might even be sleeping more than they were before. But a lot of studies now looking at actual EEG wave patterns are showing that during these couple 2 to 3 weeks after, they're not getting the deep levels of sleep as much. So they're sort of in this kind of lighter state of sleep. And that's possibly why they're requiring more sleep, but also it's not helping them because they're not able to clear as many of the byproducts. So what are some of the ways we can improve sleep? And this is great for everybody, not just if you've had a brain injury, but one of the most important things is consistency. This is also one of the hardest things, but building a sleep-wake routine. They found if you're some sort of master and can go to sleep at the same time and wake up at the same morning every single day, that's incredible for your brain. It levels out so many hormone levels and melatonin, your circadian rhythms. Obviously, for most of us, that's not very realistic, but it's definitely something to work towards. And you'll see a lot of studies encouraging anywhere from 7 to 9 hours. Now I'm seeing more even 8 to 9 is the standard, but some studies showed 7 is good. We are seeing that more sleep is better. And later wake-up times in teens. Teens sort of have a different rhythm than we do. It's probably because their brains are producing a lot more dopamine and a lot of other neurotransmitters than we do as we get older. But they benefit from sort of sleeping in a little bit. So we're actually encouraging schools and stuff to sort of shift the schedule a little bit and have teens give them that extra hour or so in the morning. Actually helps with their cognitive ability and function in school. Ben Franklin was a famous proponent of the strict schedule and sleep. And, you know, I think it served him well. I'll just go through a little example of his day because it's kind of interesting. At 5, and he kept to this apparently very strictly. And so gets up at 5 in the morning. He spends a couple hours washing and addressing his powerful goodness, which I think is a great way for all of us to start the morning. You know, whatever you interpret that as is a good way to start. Then he'd spend about 4 hours working, at which point he'd take a couple hour lunch break, and he's eating, catching up on sort of accounts, tasks, taking a little break to read, and then back to work for about 4 hours. Before he comes home that evening, puts his things in orders, listens to music and diversion, it said in his little notebook, which I think is Netflix now. And then 10 p.m. bedtime. So, you know, he's getting it's 7 hours most nights, and he's keeping to that a very strict schedule. Just as an example, here's what the average neurosurgery resident schedule looks like. We get up at about 4:30 in the morning and usually pick one of these three things. There's never time for all three of them. Usually you can always eat in the car. If you can combine any of these two things, you're really ahead of the game. 5 a.m., you're already way behind from whatever's happened in the last 20 minutes it took you to drive to work. Around 3, I usually snag a piece of pizza from the nurse's lounge. I never know how long it's been there, but I don't care. And around 9 p.m., that's when you drive home and you text, you know, catch up on all your messages. And I joke, but it's kind of a real thing. We have a lot of people fall asleep driving in neurosurgery. I had one friend, he fell asleep in the drive-thru at In-N-Out Burger. And someone was tapping on his window, And I had another one who just fell asleep in his driveway, but he didn't get the garage door open, so he drove through his own garage door. And then by the time we get home, there's always these modules. Ironically, once a month, I feel like I'm doing a sleep hygiene module, and it's late at night, keeping me awake to do some computer training on how you should be sleeping and not getting screen time, which leads me to another big factor in sleep is decreased stimulation. You know, nowadays we have so many different things, computers, TVs, phones, everything is sort of bombarding our brains constantly, and right up until the moment we go to sleep. I mean, I'm guilty of this, checking my phone, texting, Instagram, anything, you know, moments before I go to bed. And we're showing that this decreased screen time just quickly, even within a day or two, can change sleep patterns. And we recommend usually no screen time after about 8. Really, the earlier the better, but everyone, 8 is sort of like almost reasonable. I don't know if everyone knows there's blue light mode on your phone. Most phones you can set where at 8 or 9 p.m. it'll stop using the blue light, which is the most stimulating for your brain. So it'll be a little sort of browner, orangish. It takes a little getting used to, but, you know. And the studies on it are weak at best, but we do know the brain is stimulated by blue light, so it's not going to hurt to turn that off. And then obvious stuff, no coffee or sugars late in the day. You know, I know we all like a dessert snack. It's weird that we all have dessert after dinner is the one. The dessert should come with breakfast or something. It would make much more sense from a nutritional standpoint. Other studies are showing temperature is affecting how your brain sleeps. They put people in EEGs and put them in different rooms, and they actually found that temperature of the room was controlling REM levels and melatonin levels as well. So cool room is better, and what we're recommending is around 60 to 67 degrees. That's, I don't know where they got those exact numbers from the studies, but that's sort of in the 60s is where you want to be. It's a little chilly, but you know, if you have a blanket, you're good. You guys know, I mean, it's always 60 to 67 in San Francisco, right? So that's easy. Finally, this neuroplasticity. So what is neuroplasticity? And this is what we're talking about. This is the central nervous system's ability to sort of develop and create new pathways and adapt to external environments. And that is what we are getting. Both in injury, we want to improve that ability. We see it in things like stroke, where people come in and they've lost a part of their motor strip where they're not able to move their arm. But with time and training, they're able to get that movement back because the brain is finding different pathways. That one area that died, it no longer is able to use, but it develops new neural networks that can then start functioning for that arm again. And that's what we're going to start looking at from a cognitive standpoint. And we're able to do it much better now because we have increased technology. We always knew that it was there. Like I mentioned, we're seeing it in stroke, we're seeing it in sports training, athletes, martial artists who are able to, with years and years of practice, develop much, much increased hand-eye coordination. And what we're able to do now, though, are we have things like functional MRI that's actually showing us images in live time and what areas of the brain are being used when you're doing a particular task, and then we can implement a series of training and see how those areas change and expand. We can actually track it. And another one is something called electromagnetic frequency, where we're using sort of these helmets to monitor magnetic frequencies on a very cellular neutron, proton, electron level and seeing what areas of the brain are being used and watch those areas change and expand. And what we're seeing is by increasing that, we're actually improving overall recovery, and we're finding that during concussion or brain injury, those sort of ability to build pathways, the neuroplasticity is decreased or very severely slowed down. And so we want to get in early as soon as possible in an injury to sort of prevent that. It's like rehab for the brain on a more cognitive level. And the cognitive side that we're focusing on is really attention, memory, problem solving, and sort of your ability to rapidly solve problems, sort of the speed of processing. And there's a lot of different ways to do that. Everybody has a company and a study. I'm sure you guys have heard some of these, Lumosity, Brain Age, Happy Neuron. Those are some of the bigger ones that we see that have some science backing them. Another interesting one, you know, they used to always like crossword puzzles and stuff, and crossword puzzles increase your thinking, but after you've done a fewer of them, really not as many as you'd think, it really kind of plateaus out. You get good at them, and then your brain doesn't need to think that much. But social activity turns out to be one thing that every time you're looking at the fMRI or these imaging, social activity is lighting up like a Christmas tree in your brain. It requires the most thought, just carrying out normal interactions or, you know, playing cards or things like that where you're interacting with other people is using a lot more of your brain than most little puzzles are. So lastly, the sort of physical components to this. Obviously, in actual brain injury, we don't want to get you back to too much activity too quickly, so we're not like, go out and get running as soon as you can. And we sort of went through the slowly advancing activity. But overall brain health, improving that glymphatic flow can actually be a very physical process, just the way the lymphatics drain through your legs and core. Your glymphatics drain a lot in your neck and muscles there, and anytime you have brain injury, and you can also have associated muscle injury in the neck, if that's really tight, the blood flow is not as optimized, and neither is the glymphatic flow. So we're looking at sort of back at that concept of the body's the unit. If everything's not functioning smoothly, you get slowed clearance of those breakdown metabolic products in the brain. And so different ways to sort of physically optimize the brain. I talked a little bit about osteopathic medicine. There's different techniques that are fairly passive for just loosening everything in the neck and encouraging drainage, both vascular and lymphatic in the neck and head. And same with chiropractor stuff. The one caveat to both OMT and chiropractor is we don't recommend any cracking. I get about 6 vertebral artery dissections a year where the vertebral artery and you have 2, they go through the holes in the bones in your neck, and if you tear one, it's pretty bad. So we avoid the cracking if we can. Yoga is another great example of ways to sort of improve your body's overall balance in lymphatic and vascular flow. You know, yoga is really one of the most ideal scenarios because it's really using the whole body at once and sort of connecting all the muscles and then stretching and opening both sort of from an emotional but also physical standpoint. And that really, you know, has dramatic effects. Acupuncture is another very good one. Even just basic massage, we see that's very effective in loosening overall tension in the body. And then, of course, physical therapy and rehab are key. Anytime you have actual physical deficits, that's adding in the neuroplasticity side of that. So just to sort of recap, I know I've been hammering it, but you guys, nutrition, sleep, neuroplasticity, and physical health are really the keys to keeping our brains both healthy and keeping them strong so that when we get older or have injury, they're able to heal as best as possible and keep us going strong. So any questions? I think, yeah, up here.
Cycle mm-hmm. would have very healthful effects.
Yes.
So suppose you're not getting to that. Is there anything that can be done about it, either medication or daily practice?
So, sure. So a couple of the things for daily practice are the consistency. Sometimes if your brain is having trouble falling asleep or you're going to sleep at different times throughout the week, then your circadian rhythm is off. So when you're trying to sleep that night, your body actually thinks, oh, I might be waking up again. It gets a little confused. Other things, the temperature was showing that it actually encouraged the deeper levels of sleep, so keeping it cool. Melatonin is another one. The cycles are in part controlled by melatonin, so you can try that. If you've tried all of these things and you sort of run out of options, there are medications. And then there's also oftentimes some nutritional or obscure dietary things that might be causing it. You wouldn't even realize it. So there are people that'll do very kind of almost the way you would treat an allergy. It's sort of an extreme diet of eliminating everything and slowly adding it back in to see if that affects. And then the emotional component is always big too. Different things cause different sleep. You know, some people have a hard time falling asleep. Some people have a hard time staying asleep. And sometimes there's psychological stuff and that can add to that. And also physical components. People find that if they got a lot of activity and are tired and relaxed and did, you know, yoga and ran, they're able to sleep better. But it's tough. It's not a key, you know, it's different for everyone.
Hi, I have a relative who works 9 to 3, mm-hmm. and she gets home at 4 and goes straight to bed.
Uh-huh.
And so she's up all night and then has to get up in the morning to go to work for 9 a.m. And she can't understand why is it that, you know, it's a struggle to get through the day.
Naps are a very tricky thing because they can be extremely restorative, but they can also be extremely disruptive to your overall sleep cycle. So usually when we're recommending naps, we recommend really less than 20 minutes, even a 10-minute, 15-minute nap, because once you start sleeping beyond 20 minutes, your circadian rhythm kicks in and your sleep cycles get deeper, and then you sort of start going through these, you know, 3-hour cycles or 1.5-hour cycles. It becomes very hard to wake up out of that, and you'll end up sleeping for much longer. You sleep for 3 hours, then you're not going to be able to sleep at night. I almost never take naps because it's physically impossible for me to take a 15-minute nap. If I go to sleep, I'm going to do like your friend and sleep for 4 hours, and then I'm up all night. So it's sort of there's some training there. You kind of got to push yourself past having that last nap and try and stay up till you can go to bed and sleep through the night. As doctors, we're always the worst patients. So one thing I always do, and I'm not recommending this at all, is I'll get a coffee for my drive home at like 9:30 because it'll keep me awake enough to get home, finish whatever work I had. But I know I'm so tired, I'll still fall asleep by like 10:30 with the coffee. So you sort of find what works for you.
Yes, you were talking about the brain, but the brain is not the only key of the human body. Actually, is the spirit also. Is
correct.
The energy, is the battery of the igniter of the brain.
Absolutely.
And the heart is the starter of the body functional.
Uh-huh.
That's what it is.
Yeah, that's important. And that sort of, while the osteopathic principles don't address spirituality specifically, there's a very strong component to emotional health in the brain and all of your well-being. And spirituality plays a very large role in that. I'm glad you mentioned that because that is something to consider. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad I got to do this. So thank you, guys.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Dr. Ira Bowen, senior neurosurgical resident at Riverside University Health System in Southern California. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalay, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio. And the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.